Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 341 on Friday, February 13th, 2015. Greetings from downtown Denver, Colorado, which today was 50 degrees warmer than Boston, which tonight is awaiting yet another blizzard. I can hear the winter's toll in my mother's voice when I check in by phone to see how they're doing back there. Weather willing, I am going to be flying to Boston next week to help celebrate my father's 88th birthday and my grandson's 9th birthday within 3 days of each other. My guests for this week's interview are a wife and husband, Anna Kang and Christopher Wyan, whose children's book, You Are Not Small, was published by Amazon Publishing last August and recently won a prestigious award from the Association for Library Service to Children. It may be the first time I think I've featured a children's book on the show, and the conversation left me very hopeful for the future of reading. I hope you'll enjoy it as well.
Anyone with kids who watches someone read for the first time, I never would have realized how magical, and it is one of the greatest experiences I've ever seen because the world opens up.
First up in news, Amazon this week announced more international expansion for Kindle Unlimited. That's the all-you-can-read subscription program launched here in the U.S. 7 months ago. Kindle Unlimited is now available in Canada and Mexico. Earlier expansion brought the program to the U.K., Spain, France, Italy, Germany, and Brazil. Canadian and Mexican customers will be able to access 750,000 Kindle Unlimited titles for $9.99 Canadian and 129 Mexican pesos. The Canadian rollout also includes 15,000 titles in French. I couldn't find information on how many titles in Spanish might be available for the Kindle Unlimited program in Mexico. In each country, there is a 30-day free trial, which is a good way to test whether this subscription service is going to be a real benefit to you. I have subscribed to Kindle Unlimited here in the U.S. since the beginning, and I haven't actually read many of the Kindle Unlimited titles, I have to say, but I do enjoy the times when I search for a book and I discover that I can download it for free because it is one of the Kindle Unlimited titles. An example is the children's book that I wanted to read in preparation for this week's interview. It turns out it was available for Kindle Unlimited because it's published by Amazon Publishing, I presume. And another that I've been reading for a long time now is Capital in the 21st Century by Thomas Piketty. That's published by Harvard, and I am proud to report I am 73% through it. I think it's 700 pages. It's actually, you know, it's not as tough a read as I thought, and I am determined to finish it. Unlike Scribd and Oyster, Amazon's subscription service at present does not contain any titles published by the Big Five publishers, and that's kind of a shame. It's one of the things which clearly diminishes the attractiveness of the Kindle Unlimited subscription compared with those other two. Another limitation for Kindle Unlimited is that you can only have 10 KU titles at a time. When you click on your 11th, you will receive a message asking which of the other 10 you want to return. You can also see all of your Kindle Unlimited titles anytime at Manage Your Content and Devices at Amazon.com, and a handy shortcut to get there is Amazon.com/MYCD, Manage Your Content and Devices. Also in news, the updates for the Kindle for iPad, iPhone, and iPod Touch just seem to keep coming. There was one back in December. There's a new one this week, version 4.7. It adds Book Browser to the iPhone. Now, I already had this feature, Book Browser, on my iPad, and since I don't use an iPhone anymore since switching to a Fire Phone, the Book Browser edition is not really a big deal for me. But it is a well-designed view that lets you browse through Kindle Unlimited and other categories of Kindle books on your iOS device and now on your iPhone. This week's iOS update also adds a table of contents for comics, according to the description at iTunes. The third improvement in the iOS Kindle update enables students to access Kindle e-textbooks on their iPhones, making it easy to study anywhere, as the app description points out. I haven't had a chance to try an e-textbook on an iPhone yet. I imagine this is a particularly good enhancement if you have the larger iPhone 6 Plus. That's probably the one I'm going to get if the Apple Watch lures me from my beloved Fire Phone. And if I have to get an iPhone and go back because I'll want to have something to run the Apple Watch, that's what I'll get. I'll get the big one, I think. Luckily, I have till April to decide. This is going to be kind of an existential choice I've got to make. Also in the news this week, Scribd has added more than 10,000 comics and graphic novels to its subscription service, and that was enough to lure me back to reactivate my Scribd monthly subscription. That costs $8.99. The comics that Scribd has added are from top publishers, including Marvel. That's the only one that I recognize in the list in a Telluride post 2 days ago by editor Julie Monroe. Julie stated in the post that she believes Scribd is now the best value among the major subscription services. That would be Kindle Unlimited, Scribd, and Oyster. If you sign up for Oyster or Scribd, you won't be able to read the books as part of your subscription on an e-ink Kindle, but now they both have apps that you can download to your Fire tablets. You need to go to the website download because you won't be able to download apps for Scribd and Oyster from the apps for Android store at Amazon.com. So on your tablet, use your Silk browser to navigate to either Scribd, that's CRIBD.com/Kindle Fire, or oysterbooks.com/Kindle Fire. And in each case, you'll be able to download the Fire apps. The Oyster one seemed a little trickier to navigate. You had to use that ES Explorer program, which gets you into the downloads folder to get the Oyster app to open up. But the Scribd download seemed to be a little smoother in opening up on the Fire when I tried it. Another difference in terms of comics, the Scribd app doesn't seem to have that ability to pop up a frame view of the comics, which makes the text of a comic larger. On the Kindle platform, it's a nice way to just hop from one text square to the next, and it makes it much easier to read a comic book. I downloaded one of the comics that Scribd was highlighting. It's called The March Trilogy by John Lewis. That turns out to be it's a black and white graphic novel depicting Congressman Lewis's experiences in the civil rights movement. I've read the first few pages of it. It's quite a compelling way to tell a bit of history, strong drawings and kind of a narrative that takes him all the way back to his childhood before he became active in the civil rights movement. And then on to Congress. A pretty crazy thing happened when I tapped to begin reading this comic on Scribd. I got a message that popped up on my Fire saying, quote, "You're currently on page 6. However, it looks like you read to page 1 on another device on December 31st, 1969 at 5 p.m. Well, that's pretty unlikely because on that date I was a freshman in college and my only devices were a Hermes portable typewriter and an FM radio with great big AR speakers made in Cambridge, Mass. I never really read comics when I was younger, but my interest in them was sparked when I met a guy at Digital Book World, Calvin Reed of Publishers Weekly, who does what turns out to be a really good podcast about comics that I have enjoyed listening to and getting to know. It's called More to Come, and it is a good way to experience the excitement about comics. It's a genre that appears to be really undergoing terrific growth, and I'm curious enough about this. I might check out the Denver Comic Con, which is the great big conference. They have these all over the country, and the next one here in Denver is going to be in May 23rd. That'll be just before Darlene and I are scheduled to do our Eastern migration to Cambridge and Maine, so hopefully I can check it out. Finally, in news, I want to pay tribute to a New York Times writer who collapsed in the newsroom last night in New York, February 12th, and died. David Carr was only 58 years old, and his story of overcoming addiction to crack cocaine and then rising to prominence as a true leader at the Times in a difficult period is one that I've found inspiring. I've followed his coverage of the media for several years, and I've always enjoyed seeing him moderate panels in various YouTube videos. The most recent one that I watched he did at the New School just a few weeks ago about podcasting. For some time now, I've been looking for an opportunity to invite him on the podcast for a guest interview, but now that possibility has passed. An example of why I respected his reporting so much was when, in the midst of the Hachette-Amazon standoff, when others at the Times were conducting what I think many of us felt was a fairly one-sided crusade against Amazon on behalf of Hachette, David Carr, also on the staff of the Times, got the other side of the story when he ran into indie author champion Hugh Howey at Book Expo America. Howey's quotes made it into Carr's Media Equation column on June 1st, 2014, and the rest of that column benefited from Carr's nuanced curiosity about the conflict. He even confessed that, unlike media critic Jack Schaefer, who said he was boycotting Amazon's products, Carr was not going to engage in a boycott. "When I am finished with this column," he wrote, "I will press a button and a wireless printer will kick out a copy. I recently got that printer for under $100, including delivery, 2 days after I ordered it because I am a member of Amazon Prime. It wasn't delivered by drone, but it may as well have been. It seemed to appear like magic. And there's the rub. Amazon's messaging to the public depends not on what it says, but on what it does so well." As I was feeling pretty strong emotions about David Carr's passing today, I found a wonderful video filmed by WBUR, the public radio station, one of the public radio stations in Boston, last October. It had David Carr in a heartfelt conversation with Jill Abramson, the executive editor of the Times, who was fired in a highly public tumble from power. They pretty clearly were friends and continue to be friends, and their chat at BU gave a chance to see Carr's wit, empathy, and humility on full display. In addition to his battle with addiction in his 20s and 30s, Carr apparently dealt with cancer in a form that left his speaking voice a distinctive, gravelly effort. Here's an excerpt from the WBUR forum last fall.
"Almost every week brings things I had no idea was coming. I've, you know, people always, you know, come and talk to us about the future of media, and I'm like, I have no clue about what's going to happen next. You know, if you said to me a couple years ago, yeah, Jeff Bezos is going to buy the Washington Post, what? And then Pierre Omidyar, the guy who started eBay, is going to put in $250 million to newspapers, to a web product. So half a billion dollars coming out of Silicon Valley toward traditional hard news. Or if you told me even this week, oh, HBO and CBS are going to start streaming their programming over the web after they've made millions and millions of dollars working within the cable bundle. The future, you know, change comes very slowly and then it happens all at once. So I'm stunned by so much of what's going on. I've kind of gotten out of the future business. I have trouble keeping up with the present."
For the tech tip, I want to mention that I was able to easily connect my Amazon Echo with my iPad, and thus to hear podcasts and music stream from the iPad to Alexa's speaker. It was fun to make the connection, but I usually ask Alexa to play music from my Prime Music library. Sometimes I just say, "Alexa, play jazz," or "Alexa, play country music," and see what she comes up with. The jokes that Alexa tells are pretty lame, but once in a while, they're fun.
"Country music."
Oh, sorry. Alexa, stop. You can't say her name without her responding. So let's try the joke part of it, which is pretty funny. Alexa, tell me a joke.
"What's the difference between a well-dressed cyclist and a scruffy guy on a tricycle? A tire."
Alexa makes me remember when I was a boy, I had a neighborhood newspaper, the Clay Pit Flyer in Wayland, Massachusetts, that I printed on a hectograph, which is a tray of jelly that captured marks from a purple pencil on the original and then made copies possible. A favorite feature of my news package, I was probably 8 years old, was the Riddle of the Week, and I cribbed that from a book titled 1001 Riddles for Children by George L. Carlson. Naturally, Amazon has a used copy of it available, and I'm sure it's the right one because I recognize the red cover with a laughing parrot on it. So I mention this because sometimes I think Alexa is getting her jokes from the same book. It's still endearing, and it's a cute way to introduce her to visitors at the house here in Denver. Time now for the interview. creation of an illustrated children's book would probably not have been the next career move one might have predicted for Anna Kang and Christopher Wyant. She has a Tufts degree in international relations and Asian studies and worked at the Council on Foreign Relations before turning to film and television after earning an MFA at USC's School of Cinematic Arts. He is a cartoonist for The New Yorker magazine and editorial cartoonist for The Hill, a Washington, D.C. newspaper specializing in coverage of Congress. They are married, the parents of two children, two daughters, and now Anna and Chris have created an award-winning children's book for beginning readers. The title is You Are Not Small, and it was published in August of last year by Two Lions, an imprint of Amazon Publishing. The book was recently awarded the 2015 Geisel Award, named after Theodore Seuss Geisel, also known as Dr. Seuss. The Association for Library Service to Children gives this award annually to the author and illustrator of the most distinguished American book for beginning readers published in English in the U.S. I connected with Anna and Chris by Skype on Wednesday, February 11th at their home in New Jersey. I began by asking about the legendary children's author Dr. Seuss, for whom their recent award is named.
You know, he started in the 50s and into the 60s, and it really got going in the mid-60s, so he dominated my whole childhood. His books were all coming out at that time. And what I loved about his books, not only did he have beautiful art, but there's always a really interesting message. The content was great as well. So as you got older, you grew with the book.
Yeah.
Right? You know, so in the beginning, you just loved the pictures and the funny rhymes. And I spent a lot of time just going over all his brushwork and, you know, how he does water and architecture, and it's really, really interesting. Turns out to be very Southern California, I guess. But he was very influential for me.
Yeah, same here. I think I had most of his books growing up from an early age, probably from the beginning until preschool for sure, and early elementary school. We read almost all of them at home, at school. They were a huge formative part of our reading and our education. I love the pictures. They with Dr. Seuss. Oh my God! I loved his drawings. I loved the words, the familiarity of the words, the rhythm of the words. So it was a huge part.
It seems like there's more words in a Dr. Seuss book than there are in this book. Does that mean that you're aiming at a kind of a different level of entry of beginner reader, or?
I didn't consciously write the story You Are Not Small with any specific aged audience in mind, nor did I, you know, think consciously about Seuss either, Dr. Seuss. The story just came out the way it came out because writers and artists, I think all of your material comes from everywhere you've been and who you've met and what you've felt up until this point. So what basically popped out is a dialogue I've kind of had in my own head since I was a kid, which is, you know, kids always say, you're this, or you're that, or you're not, and a lot of adults do that too, but mostly kids, that's how they speak. This is how they identify and categorize the world, and it can be very hurtful, intentionally or otherwise. So when you grow up, like I did as a minority, I was always told I was this, or I was not that, and I didn't see myself that way. I saw myself as just me. That there was nothing wrong with me or there was nothing strange about me. I was just who I was. And so I was pretty confident, that must have come from my parents, about that. That, no, I'm fine the way I am. And it only as I got older did I realize, and you travel and you see there are other people in the world besides the, you know, the handful you see on your block or in your school. There's a whole world of different shapes and colors. And we are all normal and different. So when I sat down to write a story, this dialogue from when I was a kid just came out. And so it's a lot shorter because I feel like it makes its point pretty quickly. but yeah, the difference in terms of Seuss and this is, yes, his books are much, much longer. But the similarities are the sight words, S-I-G-H-T, the sight words that teachers use to teach children how to read, which are the most commonly used words and found words in books. And so that is a similarity that they're repeating over and over in the book, and it reinforces beginning readers. in terms of how to read.
So where in your creative process did Chris come in with the illustrations?
Well, from the very beginning, because when I first wrote the story, we showed it to our agent, Holly McGee, of Pippin Properties, and she really liked it. And the way she likes to operate is, since we were untested, unknown children's book, I mean, Chris is a well-known artist, but I was not well-known. I'm not well-known. So what she wanted to do was send it out with the story, but she wanted the manuscript to go with a sample of art. So she wanted to see what would one of these characters look like so that the publishers could see. So Chris, from the very beginning, created the purple character first.
And which is the smaller one.
Yes.
The smaller one, yeah. We had a lot of different types. I mean, we did, at one point, we were doing mock-ups of where it would be, a rhino and a mouse. And, you know, we had different, playing with size and what would be a good, and trying to make something, we were very specific. What was nice about this is that it's rare you have the author and the illustrator together. You know, usually what they do is the author writes it, it goes out, then the publishing house matches it with an illustrator that they find. And in this one, we had a constant dialogue while Anna was writing it, while I was drawing it, and there was always a, we both have the same sensibilities, so there was a constant dialogue as it's evolved, so which really made us kind of a real joint project, which is rare from my experience.
Let's jump in and tell my listeners, how do you summarize the story so they can kind of picture what we're talking about here when they picture the book?
The story is that we have a little creature who is minding its, we don't really specify if it's, you know, literally what, if the female or a male. So it's a creature, and it's not any specific animal. It's just a little creature guy, and he's minding his own business, and then a larger kind of creature comes and says that he is small. Well, the little guy doesn't like that. He says, actually, no, I'm not small. It's that you're big. So they go and have this debate of who is X and who is Y, and it escalates and gets a little heated. And they bring their own respective camps in to prove, no, it's not that I am small, because look at all these fellas, they're just like me. And they go back and forth until finally we have two unexpected guests kind of plop into the middle of this argument and shows them that, no, it's all about perspective, who you're standing next to and looking around the world. You can be both small and you can be both big and small. And so this is what they all learn. They all learn that small, you can be any different size. It's, you're not just one thing.
I mean, I'm looking at the pictures now, and the small creature is, as you say, he's purple. And they seem to have very similar noses, as if maybe they're related distant cousins or something. And the big ones almost look like bears.
Yeah.
But were those the first that occurred to you, Chris, as you were sketching what these critters in Anna's story might look like?
It's great that you noticed that, because that really was one of the things we want to focus on, is that the two creatures think they're wildly different, but I have to assure them that we all know the gag, which is they're not that different. They're actually far more similar than they realize, but they're adamant. They're adamant that this is not the case. And so you really want to play with that part of this of the script, of the story. Like Anna, what I loved about the story when Anna wrote it, which interested me, was that it's really concise. It boils down, and it's very metaphorical, which is like the work I do in The New Yorker, which is all about boiling things down to their purest and the simplest and the shortest you can get there. If you can do it in one line, that's even better. So when we were doing the characters, originally we thought maybe they would be something that just had, they're just non-entity, you know, they weren't animals, they weren't things, and I couldn't draw it, actually. I couldn't come up with it. So I really felt like I wanted to do something that was very tactile and kind of fuzzy and furry, so you have that warmth that you want to kind of touch them and that you have this instant likability. But then at the same time, I didn't want them to be, oh, this is a dog and this is a cat. You know, I really wanted to be there. It's this own little universe.
Yes, from the beginning, Chris and I talked about and agreed that whatever he decided was going to be the characters, they were going to be the same species. So I wanted it, everything as much as possible to be equal, except their size and color, because visually it looks better than if they were just all the same color. We just thought it would be more dynamic if they were opposing colors as well as opposing sizes.
Right.
But we wanted children to consciously or otherwise come away with the message, they're the same, but just their size with each other. So that's where that came from.
In the clip that I watched on YouTube, Chris, where you're talking about the difference between doing a cartoon for the New Yorker, which you said is your tool is a rapier, and a political cartoon like for the Hill is a hatchet. This is a whole third universe you're working in. Is there a different tool or weapon that occurs to you?
I live usually in a pretty cynical world, or it's the world of politics, or the world of kind of social comment, and I'm dealing with adults and trying to bring out their fears and make humor through it to make them laugh through this. It's kind of therapeutic. And with kids and children's books, it's such a different world. It's really where...
It's more positive.
It's completely positive. I think the other one is positive, too. It's just I'm taking them from someplace. I'm trying to bring them into a positive world. And with kids' books, what's exciting, the thing I love most is that you're getting kids to, especially with this level, is... You're getting kids from infancy up to read for the first time. And we have two daughters, and I recently, we've watched our daughters read, and the process. Right. And anyone with kids who watches someone read for the first time, I never would have realized how magical. Exciting. And it is one of the greatest experiences I've ever seen because the world opens up. It's like traveling to another country, and you all of a sudden, you can use a few words. And now it's not the world's not so mysterious anymore, and I'm a part of it for the first time. So that whole, it's such a different kind of experience. But I do find the approach in some ways with the art is I am still looking to make my drawings as potent as possible. Again, simplifying, making them as strong as they can to bring out the most in the story where I'm able to. And so that's very similar to the other work I do.
So the tool would be?
I don't have one tool.
It's not a weapon, I guess.
It's not a weapon.
It's definitely not a weapon. I don't know what it'd be. Like a sandwich.
It's maybe a lollipop or something.
Lollipop.
I could picture that, to the extent that you're motivated, probably you both are in different ways of changing the world, helping the world, us to see things in different light. Your leverage here is much greater than even if you hit something out of the park for the New Yorker or the Hill, because if you get, thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of kids going through a book like this and in some deep level getting the point that, Anna, you experienced as a child, do you ever think that this is possibly a lot more significant work than the stuff that you have done?
I think if I walked around thinking how significant I am in my work, I'd be in big trouble.
right. Sorry, delete that.
I thank you for your point, and wouldn't that be the greatest thing ever, wouldn't it? Right? I mean, isn't that the beautiful thing about working with children and trying to shape in a good way what their values and choices might be in the future and how they relate to other people? I mean, that's, if it does anything to make somebody feel less alone or even have somebody think twice before they decide somebody else, to pick on somebody, that would be, huge. That would be enormous. It would be a wonderful thing if that's, would be one of the results.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's when we have a real soft spot for teachers and librarians.
Yeah.
Because
the
they
best.
Really, kind of get us all started. We all have this common experience. We all have the person that we know, and we've had, libraries that we love and librarians we love and teachers. That all kind of moved us up to get where we've gotten to be a part of that in even a small way.
Yeah.
Phenomenal.
Yeah. So, yes, I think the answer, definitely what you're saying is true, that... What better world and what better audience is there to reach than children, right? I mean, what you're saying in terms of communication, right? Communicating your message or your feelings about things. Mm-hmm. You can do it for adults, like Chris does all the time with the New Yorker and politics and political cartoons, and that's great too because it creates dialogue. But with children, I mean, they're just beginning to shape who they are and how they feel about things.
Yeah.
So it's really amazing.
And I have my grandson's almost 16 months old, so I'm seeing that same magical moment. And to me, it's a total mystery because he starts laughing at things in his favorite book, but you really have no idea what he thinks is funny.
Right.
And what is getting in? You said earlier that the Dr. Seuss books, you as a child, you react to them by the words and the images. And the message just comes later. That's fascinating to me. Because I suppose at 16 months old, I doubt a message like this would be resonating yet.
No, I think your grandson definitely his at that age, he can identify people and who are strangers, who is his parents, who are his loved ones, who are his friends. So he's identifying that person doesn't look like my mother. So he's seeing differences for sure, but the deeper message will probably come in preschool when he starts to do more peer related things and compare with his peers.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the publishing history of this. The book was published August 5th, 2014, by Two Lions. That's an imprint of Amazon. One thing I've sort of assumed and just covering the space is that Amazon Publishing moves perhaps more quickly than more traditional publishers. But I wonder if you could just tell the story of how long it took from the first idea for this book to having it published on August 5th of last year.
It actually took a while. Yeah, it wasn't any faster, I think, than or slower than I think at just any traditional house. We sold the idea in the fall of 2012 to Two Lions, so about 2 years, almost 2 years.
Yeah,
and
the production end is relatively quick.
Yeah,
and then there's a lot of getting the art ready, sending it back and forth to the printer, and then getting the marketing all ready. That takes a long time to also start the distribution.
Yeah, I think
so. That's the bigger chunk of it.
I think it's mostly about.
But it does take about 2 years.
Yeah, it's about. It could have been I think a year and a half, but they chose to release it in the fall.
Yeah.
Specifically, so it's anywhere from a year and a half to 2 years.
Hmm. One of the challenges I think Amazon Publishing has had is getting books placed in bookstores, Barnes & Noble, some of the independent chains. Have you seen your books in bookstores?
Well, not Barnes & Noble, but we're actually very fortunate that we have three independent bookstores in our neighborhood.
Yeah.
So we have three, and all three carry it.
Oh, that's great.
So we are thrilled, and I think they're pretty pleased too, honestly, because it sells.
Yeah, and I called the Tatter Cover here in Denver, just curious, and they didn't have it in the store, but they said they could order it for me, so there were no barriers evident there.
Some people, some stores, yes, they will not, and others will.
Yeah, most. I mean, even Barnes & Noble, you can order it through barnesandnoble.com.
Yeah, which is ironic. But
So they'll ship it, but they're just not ready to display it yet in terms of, I think, what their histories are ironed out.
Yeah. Most of what I focus on is the Kindles and e-readers and tablets. I'm curious if you think it's better to read You Are Not Small to a child on paper or electronically, or if you want to weigh into the technology of it, where would you come out?
I'm going to fall right onto the old school. I mean, I'm still, painted this whole thing with watercolors as opposed to Photoshop, which I use, but not for this. I like to have a book in hand. And I really do. And one of the nice things with children's books, especially picture books, which is a little bit different, I think, is that it's about you and your child or you and your grandchild sitting and reading together. You know, there's this nice intimate, or even with a group of kids. And so there's something to be able to hold and I think turn, and you can get a little bit closer. I don't think the technology's there yet to give that same experience because it's so visual. And there's something about it's different than reading a just a screen book. Yeah, so I like a book.
How about you, Anna?
At the same time, there are merits for it being an e-book, which is that it's you can get it instantaneously.
A car drive
anywhere, any place, anytime, any moment. You don't need to go to necessarily a store that it may not have it in your area. You don't have to wait for it to arrive in the mail, and children really love, the devices. So we're also, it was interesting. We thought about that actually when we were doing the story, and specifically Chris did with the art that we wanted. I mean, you can talk about that. Why don't you talk about the electronics and the screen?
Yeah. So we knew that we wanted to make sure that it's very graphically identifiable, so that because people will be now looking out on screens, and even we thought about we made our cover, which Anna actually designed. Our cover came up with the idea, So, which is to say, to have this cover that we know that it's going to be selling on Amazon, so it's going to be a teeny tiny little box, and we really want somebody to be able to see it from far away because it's not going to be sitting on a shelf, at least not initially. And so we were really, we don't fear the digital world by any means. And so with this one, we did make actually some changes in how we wanted it to be.
And I think in particular, Chris's illustrations work well on devices because they're so colorful, large, and graphic. There are some stories they just would not do well, I think, on a Kindle, but Chris's illustrations definitely do. So it's still a great experience reading the e-version of our book, for sure.
When the new creature comes down and you just see his feet, I'm looking at this page here, the boom page. I tell you, when I flipped to that on my Kindle Fire, it's just like, you know, I think it would have been a little bit more of an impact than if I had flipped the page, because it just came right at you.
Right. Well, I think maybe we can get a sound effect in there. It'll really.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. Make it vibrate in your hand or something.
Yeah, right. Well, that would knock you off your seat.
Are you optimistic that beginning readers now are as likely to become avid book readers in the future, a similar proportion of the population, or do you fear that this is kind of a dying art and that it's just harder and harder to create the kind of passionate readers that I'm sure the three of us are?
I don't think it's harder, in my opinion. I think children will always love and need and want to read books, and I don't think the device and the electronic age and all that is going to, I just don't think so. I mean, yes, there are definitely a million more distractions for children, and that is a challenge, absolutely, where you could be reading a book, but I think children will always, always love to read, especially books when they're younger with beautiful illustrations that speak to you. And that you can identify with. It's a huge feeling that you can't get from a video game, in the same way. It will always be there. I feel like I'm not worried.
Yeah, I mean, our kids, like all kids now, they're unbelievably versed in electronics. From the minute they're born, it's wild how that happens. But at the same time, I notice that there's only so much they can do, and then they kind of burn. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing like, I think all kids like to sit down, and I'm sure there's some, great mapping of the brain that goes on, but they're where they really put time into something, either something they're playing with or something that they're reading. And picture books do this, where they take that same time, like I did when I was a kid. I see that myself in them, where you're really going over it, And also, children, it's real to them. For us, they're images. For when you're a kid, especially younger, these are real characters.
Because I think children are actually, they're giving to the process. They're not just sitting and receiving, and it's not passive. It's a very, it's an engaged experience that you can't replicate, So I think it will always be there.
I'm very hopeful.
What are you working on now?
Our second book featuring our purple and orange guy is due out, Two Lions, September 1st, 2015.
Yep.
It's called That's Not Mine.
It's a follow-up.
And it's about sharing or not sharing. And after that, in spring of 2016, HarperCollins will publish another picture book, and it's called Can I Tell You a Secret?
I can see a theme here, and I hope that there's a lot of things you remember from childhood. They're going to make it into this form.
Yeah, it's funny how that happens.
Our childhoods are deep.
That's great. Thanks very much to you both.
Thank you, Len.
Len, thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
In content this week, I want to alert you to a good source of reviews for self-published books. It's Blue Ink Review at blueinkreview.com. And I'm going to be speaking with Patty Thorne, one of its co-founders, for next week's show. It turns out I know Patty from before Kindle and podcasting days, when I wrote one or two book reviews for her at the late, great Rocky Mountain News here in Denver. It was one of the first major city newspapers to fold in the face of the digital revolution. If you'd like to get an advanced look at this promising new player in the book publishing ecosystem, please point your browser to blueinkreview.com and tune in next week to hear from Patty Thorne. On the Fire Tablet and Fire TV front, there were a couple of notable content additions this week. Sling TV's app for Fire TV is now available, and I signed up for the free 14-day trial to try it out. It was pretty easy to download the app to my Fire TV, except it is a little cumbersome to enter an email address and password with that letter-by-letter moving of the cursor on the controller. But luckily, you only have to do that once. Darlene and I don't watch hardly any cable TV, so this Sling TV app on Fire TV does perhaps bring us closer to cutting the cable. For $19.99 a month after the free trial period, you have access to live sports, lifestyle, family, and news channels. This app received some real buzz at CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, in January in Las Vegas. It received a Best of Show award at that big conference. Amazon's release about Sling TV noted other content additions for Fire TV, noting that the amount of programming has increased fivefold since Fire TV was introduced in April of last year. The other content addition this week is Amazon's first hour-long original drama series titled Bosch, based on the Michael Connelly hero Harry Bosch, and that's a series that has sold nearly 50 million copies worldwide. I haven't read any of these books, I don't think, but Darlene has read them all, and she recommends them, so she's going to be interested in trying out this new show. 10 episodes are available exclusively on Prime Instant Video in the US, UK, and Germany. You can watch these on Fire TV, of course, but also on any device that plays Prime Instant Video, such as the Kindle Fire tablets, Fire Phone, or Amazon video apps for iOS and Android. I want to close with a couple of your comments. Mike Harris emailed, if you have access to a recent model iPhone, iPad running iOS 8, there's what seems to be a noteworthy new writing voice-to-text, speech-to-text proofreading app, Voice Dream Writer. There's a video on the product page that demos and covers its features better than its own literature. Literature fails to mention voice-to-text dictation, which is based on Apple's voiceover assistive tech. While apparently targeted at the visually impaired, the app looks to be also quite useful and attractive to normally sighted authors. It includes an unusual, promising, dynamic, manipulatable outlining feature. You can find it at voicedream.com/writer. Mike adds, I've seriously suggested to its creator that he also consider a voice audio only, no optional display, no optional keyboard, word processor, not just for the visually impaired, but also for writing while walking, exercising, etc. Not just simple dictation, but the full boat of drafting, proofing features. It could be revolutionary. If you're interested, I'll have a link in the show notes to the website, and there's about a 20-minute video in which the creator of this app talks about why he created it and what it does. Here's the start of it to give you a taste of it.
Hi, I'm Winston Chen, the founder of VoiceDream and the developer of VoiceDream Reader. Today, I'm going to introduce you to my new app, VoiceDream Writer. It's a writing tool whose mission is to help everyone write better. It does that by reducing mistakes in writing, helping with word usage, and improving structure or organization of your writing. I'll walk you through how this app does these things. First, it has integrated text-to-speech, and that's how it helps writers make fewer mistakes. Let's check it out.
At this point, the video shows a kind of a word processing screen, and as each word is typed, you can hear the typing in the background. The word is spoken, and then when you type a period, the whole sentence is spoken.
Hi, I'm a writing tool that gives you feedback as you. I'm a writing tool that gives you feedback as you type.
Interesting. I'm sure any of you who write know that it's very hard to catch your own errors, and maybe this is a tool that could help, and I appreciate Mike sending that along. Bill Pugh wrote, I believe it's P-A-U-G-H, it might be Puff, but I'm going to go with Pugh. In any event, Bill wrote, my Echo arrived yesterday. I have to say it is a pretty neat device. Setup was easy. However, I did something when I was going through the app, and I could swear Alexa said, I don't know what happened. I have the app on my iPod and iPad and will add it to my Fire HDX. Voice recognition is good, but it occasionally interprets my request incorrectly, especially when asking for a radio station. I actually like using the app to search Prime playlists or the iHeartRadio and TuneIn stations. Then all I have to do is press the item I want and it plays. I like the fact that I could ask it the forecast for St. Augustine this coming Sunday. a lot of sun with temperatures in the 50s. Sounds good. I think Amazon has a great new item, Bill writes. It works well, looks good, and sounds great. I would agree with that assessment. That's it for this week. Next week's show will feature my conversation with Patty Thorne, which we plan to record here at our home in Denver, and I will put the rest of the show together in our Cambridge home if I manage to sneak into Boston's Logan Airport between storms. Music for my podcast is from an original Thelonious Monk composition named Well You Needn't. This version is Ramonk by Eval Monagat on the Variations in Time, a Jazz Perspective CD by Public Transit Recording. This is Len Edgerly in downtown Denver for the Kindle Chronicles. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.